Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. Randall Saito's escape from the Hawaii State Hospital and flight to the mainland last month were the kind of dramatic episodes that focus public attention on a much broader issue, in this case the issue of mental illness. Saito had, by his own admission, killed someone 38 years ago and had been declared innocent by reason of insanity. He'd lived at the state mental hospital ever since. Beyond the expected questions about security at the facility, how is insanity defined by the courts and by the healthcare system? And how are the different varieties of mental illness diagnosed and treated? We're asking listeners to weigh in with their own questions and comments at this number, 941-3689, or if you're on a neighbor island, 1-877-941-3689. With me and News Director Bill Dorman in our studio are Tricia Kajimura, Executive Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii, Mark Fridovich, Chief of the Adult Mental Health Division for the State Department of Health, and Ronette Kawakami, Richardson Law School Dean, former co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, and former Hawaii public defender. Mark, let me start by saying, let's establish right off that there are things you can't comment about with the Saito case. It's a pending investigation. But I think people are curious about the steps that that led him to be at the facility.
The state hospital is our only mental hospital in Hawaii, only public mental hospital. Mm-hmm. The admissions for the last 7 years have been entirely court commitments. Mm-hmm. The most frequent kind of court commitment is individuals unfit to stand trial, unfit pending restoration of fitness. Mm-hmm. The second most frequent happens to be individuals who were released previously and return on violation of conditional release. But the third are admissions for individuals who were found not guilty by reason of insanity. So after an individual was found fit for trial, not guilty by reason of insanity is a defense that they can offer. Mm-hmm. And it's at the determination of the judge, or in the case of a jury trial, the jury, to make the determination that's true. And if true, they're committed to the state hospital, not guilty by reason of insanity. In Hawaii, there are a couple of different features to insanity defense and not guilty by reason of insanity commitment. But most important for our purposes is a person found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to the state hospital is committed to the custody of the director of health. They're committed to a hospital. They're there for treatment for underlying mental disease, if that exists, and for rehabilitation in order to prepare them eventually for successful community living. In the case of some charges, serious charges generally, a court's involved in the determination that the individual is ready to transition to less restrictive levels of care and eventual discharge from the hospital. And as I mentioned a second ago, one of the options for the court is to release on conditions. It's actually called conditional release, and it looks like a post-release, post-adjudication mental health probation where a person has to follow certain rules in the community or else they're at risk for being returned to state custody. But important for you and our listeners today is to understand it's a hospital. It's not a prison. There are patients, not inmates. They're there for treatment of foundational mental health problems and to the extent to which we can also to prepare them for a successful transition to community living, and that might consist of rehabilitation, education, preparation for some kind of vocational situation, and to be successful at residential living generally, have relationships and be a positive member of the community.
Ronna, you dealt with the insanity of defense as a public defender, and let me see if I understand what Mark was just explaining to me. You are judged fit to stand trial, able to make decisions for your own defense, and yet you can still be adjudicated to be insane at the end of the same trial?
So it's not really a trial process at first. So mm-hmm. The first threshold question, like Mike said, is that the first threshold question is whether a person is fit to proceed. So you would be filing a motion after you have some kind of indication from your client that this person doesn't understand what's going on, they can't assist in their own defense. So you would file a motion with the court, ask the court to basically appoint a three panel of three doctors, one of which has to be a psychiatrist, and the other two can be either a psychologist or a psychiatrist or an MD. Most often it's one psychiatrist and two psychologists who do separate and individual reports on the client. They need to find out whether or not the client lacks the capacity to understand the proceedings or cannot assist his own defense. If both of those are true, the person is unfit to stand trial and must be sent to the hospital or other kind of treatment until they are fit to proceed. Once there's a finding that the person is fit, the person can understand the proceedings, they can assist their own defense, they can make decisions together with their attorney, then you have the next step, which is determining whether or not they lack the capacity to understand what they did was wrong, or they lack the volitional ability to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. So one is cognitive, one is volition. So one is, can I understand whether this is what I did was wrong? The other is whether or not they could control themselves to that extent. So it's one or the other. Some jurisdictions require both. Our jurisdiction requires one of them. And if one of them is true and is proven as an affirmative defense by the defense side, then the person would be deemed not guilty by reason of insanity, which is different from saying they're innocent. Not guilty is a term of art. Innocent means you haven't done anything at all, not involved in it completely. Not guilty means it doesn't rise to the requirements of the law.
Innocent meaning you had no ability to judge the effect of your actions?
No, the word innocent is a term of art. So it's like not guilty is a term of art. Not guilty is the standard that we use in the law, in criminal law. Mm-hmm. You're not guilty. You're not considered innocent. Innocent means you weren't involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
You were completely not involved. Not guilty means that the prosecution has not met their burden.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to let me just interject for a second. We do want listeners to weigh in, and this we're going beyond the issues of insanity and the insanity defense to talk about mental health and mental health care in general. And we're asking you to call these numbers, 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, 1-877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands. Bill Dorman, our news director, is here with me. Tricia Kajimura of Mental Health Hawaii. Mark Fridovich, chief of the Adult Mental Health Division for the Department of Health, and Ronette Kawakami, dean at the Richardson Law School. So please do call in, because we really want to broaden the discussion to include what people are thinking out there. Tricia, let me ask you a very broad-based question. Mm-hmm. What's the state of mental health care in Hawaii? You know, how are we doing?
I think that in Hawaii we have a really committed community of providers and also advocates, as well as family members and people who really care about the mental health of our community members. We can always do better. We actually do need more providers, especially psychiatrists and psychologists who are well qualified to provide psychotherapy to people suffering from mental health issues or mental illness. And we really need to look at how we're serving our youth and whether we are providing enough of the prevention and support services to young people that can hopefully help to lessen some of the acute problems we're seeing within adults.
What constitutes prevention?
Prevention can be, it really is a large umbrella, right? So at young ages, it means social emotional learning and the things that we do in school to help children understand their feelings and get along with each other, their families, cope with their emotions. At another level, it's screening for mental health issues, which can be done in doctor's offices. It can be done online. People can self-screen, and actually people are from a very young age now that access to websites are so easy. And then it's making sure that people who are showing symptoms or problems related to mental health are able to access the care that they need.
Let me ask briefly, just going around the room, in terms of your sense of where we are right now in the state of mental health in Hawaii. Are conditions stable, improving, or deteriorating? Tricia, let's start with you.
I would say that we definitely are still feeling the effects of cuts to our mental health system that were made around 2008 to 2010. We are still recovering from rollbacks in funds to the Department of Health that are used for case management, funding of the state hospital, all of those services that are so critical to the safety net for people with mental illness. But we are also seeing improvements in what younger people are exposed to. So our youth are becoming more educated and more vocal about mental health, their needs, and how they can be met.
Right now?
So anything I say would be anecdotal because I'm not really in the business of mental health issues. But I do think the younger people are more cognizant of mental health issues as being something that is part of life and that it's not a badge of dishonor or something that's to be embarrassed about. So they do have that understanding, and I think that's a good thing.
Mark, I saw you nodding with the more qualified help needed in terms of state and in terms of resources in that direction.
I think Tricia's analysis is generally correct. We are still recovering on the state side and the general system side from the cuts secondary to the financial crisis of 2008. We've been rebuilding adult mental health programs through the course of 2014, 2016. Our initial focus was on crisis services, crisis mobile outreach, and our crisis line, which is a service that anyone in Hawaii can access if they need to. And we've had a couple of promising practices in intensive case management programs targeting individuals at high risk for hospitalization, high risk for incarceration, and also individuals who have homelessness and substance use challenges in the community. But we've got a long way to go. We need more providers, as Tricia outlined. She noted psychiatrists and psychologists. There actually are a whole range of providers that we need more of, and we need more programs and program capacity, especially to address the needs of individuals with higher or greater behavioral challenges.
Tricia, let me ask you about one area that's very visible to folks in, say, in Honolulu particularly, but homelessness and the links between homelessness and mental illness. Where are we now? Point in time count comes out. That's a self-reported situation where people say, yes, I am suffering or I'm not. What's your sense of where we are in that area, and is that improving, deteriorating, or is that remaining the same? Hard to say, I know.
Yeah, so we have made some improvements in homelessness. There have been people who have been gone into shelter. What I'm most concerned about in that area of homelessness is, are we preventing people from becoming homeless? So even as we're helping people off the street, are we preventing more people from becoming homeless because it's so hard to pay rent, to find affordable housing? The mere cost of living in Hawaii is a major contributor, or the contributor to homelessness. And sometimes it's hard to say what comes first, mental illness or homelessness or other problems and homelessness, because it's also tied closely together. But certainly if we had more affordable rental housing available and truly affordable rental housing, I think the problem could decrease further.
We're talking about mental illness. We'd love to hear from you. If you have some views on this, if you have some questions for our guest, 941-3689. If you're calling from Oahu, toll free from Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689.
Bill made a reference earlier to self-reporting, and I would think that would be one of the real difficulties in dealing with mental illness is stigma. Right, reluctance to self-report, reluctance to admit. People with other types of severe illnesses or even mild illnesses aren't reluctant to talk about them. But mental illness seems to be an entirely different area. Is that a fair description?
I think that is. Stigma still does play a large role in how people cope with mental illness.
What can communities do to erase that stigma?
So one thing that we work on is education of the community. The more people know about mental illness, the less scary it is. We want to normalize that conversation and help people understand how they can get help, take some of that fear and anxiety out of that process, and hopefully that will help things move along.
We've got a caller on the line from Hilo. David from Hilo, are you... We've got a call coming in. Let's put it that way. But As to the whole thing of the stigma associated, you see that all the time, yeah?
Yeah, this is a challenge for individuals served by adult mental health and served by our partners providing mental health supports for adults. It's an unfortunate consequence that some of the features of mental illnesses do tend to put a lot of strain on relationships. That can be family relationships, friendships, and the like. And without those sources of support, it makes the challenge of addressing the mental illness even harder. So programs like this are helpful, so we want to thank you for this and this opportunity to talk with you and the larger public about these important issues. Understanding that most of the people with mental illness are going to be have options for treatment and recovery happens every day are really important messages to get out. And through social support, that can make a big difference in people's lives.
That's kind of why I wanted to move us away from the more, you know, volatile subject of severe mental illness and insanity, because it would seem that mental illness to some degree, mental health in our society, that no one is unaffected.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. It's something that we all need to be aware of, just as we all care about our physical health. Mental health is part of that. And we need to look at what we're doing to support our own mental health and how we are helping the community in general.
What kind of things do we do that have a negative impact on our mental health?
It's a lot related to stress, I would say. So not getting enough sleep, pushing ourselves past our limits in terms of the hours we work, the projects we take on, the relationships that we keep, all of those can really pile up and tip us over into an unhealthy place.
You asked a question earlier about prevention, and one of the other features besides what those that Trish noted was early intervention after an incident of trauma. Early intervention after a crisis situation can help alleviate or mitigate the risk of a future more severe problem. So we are all the time looking at and trying to understand the role that trauma has played in the lives of our clients, but also generally as a community, as a public, as neighbors, sensitivity to the trauma crises that we're all experiencing can be a helpful thing. And being available, being sensitive, and being appropriately responsive can make a difference.
Do people tend to isolate themselves after a trauma, move in just the opposite direction?
It's a natural reaction, of course, and it's unfortunate. And I'm not offering that we should do unmitigated outreach. But sensitivity to that, and we don't want isolation to grow, that runs the risk of alienating the person for potential sources of support, potential sources of help, and potential sources for referral to needed supports in the community.
That can be an after effect of trauma, right? Leave me alone to, you know, deal with my problems on my own.
Yes, but people do respond to trauma in different ways and cope in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that can also lead into substance use.
Yeah.
And if it's not, you know, addressed by support systems, or if the person doesn't have the individual resources to realize what they're doing, mm-hmm. then that can spin out into larger problems.
There's a caller on the line from Hilo. David from Hilo, are you there? David, we've got you on the line. You had a question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep, hear you just fine.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make a connection between mental health and our diet. It's astounding that this year alone there's been over 390 mass murder shootings in the United States, and you got it. I think that there's definitely something going wrong here with this kind of status. So what I also understand is that this country has been consuming mass quantities of dead animals that have been slaughtered and butchered and gone through horrible, you know, painful existence. And everybody that has got enough ignorance to live in denial and apathy and eats that stuff is directly affected by it.
David, thanks for your call. How much has much in terms of science, Mark, been established about relationship between food, diet, and mental health? It would seem a pretty elaborate, pretty much of a reach. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I could comment about that specifically. For the individuals that we support and individuals generally getting mental health supports in the community, we do try to take a look at the whole person, and we look at the whole person, and we're very concerned about diet, about exercise, diet, and appropriate stress reduction. Critical features, we've got a project through our community mental health center supported by federal grant funds called Living Well to integrate between primary care and behavioral health supports. And diet plays an important role in that, as does exercise and as does other appropriate stress reduction techniques that people can use, participating in appropriate faith-based activities and things like that. So we're sensitive to the issue of diet. It turns out that some of the medicines that individuals with severe mental illness take also create particular challenges in terms of metabolic disorder. And so we want them to lead successful, happy, healthy lives. And that means taking into account diet, taking into account exercise, and taking into account the whole person and a whole person approach, integrated approach to both their physical health care and their behavioral health care.
You know, Mark, you talk about the integrated approach. There was a study by a group, the Sentencing Project, in 2015 showing states with less access to mental health care have more adults who wind up in the criminal justice system. That link between mental illness, and again, this is across a spectrum in terms of that, not just severely mentally ill, but in terms of that as part of incarceration. Ronette, in terms of your dealings with folks within the system, how much have you seen that as mental illness as a part of folks in incarceration?
I think there's a to answer that, I think there's a range of mental illness. I think all of you agree that there's it can be something as simple as, you know, I'm very stressed at work, and you end up yelling at your children or having a difficult relationship and domestic violence into the situation, to something like murder. So there's this big range of mental health issues in our community. Of course, in all the cases I've seen, every time you see a case, you look at the person and you think, if they had only gotten some mental health treatment when they were younger, if only someone had stepped in when they were 5 years old, when their mother left the family and there was no one to take care of them, if only all these services were available to them, they wouldn't be involved in criminal activity. So what do you do about it? What can we do about it? I think it's, again, one of those situations where it's money, it's rules and legislation, it's getting the necessary psychologists and psychiatrists involved. I wanted to go back to something that you had said a little earlier, and you know, I think the universities are doing a good job of getting treatment out for there for the students, also ADA accommodations. Especially University of Hawaii, we have an award-winning counseling center who they need a lot. And this is my pitch for them, is that they really do need more personnel and more money and service to improve, get more people in to help them, because they do a fantastic job of helping our students. Even the faculty are like first responders in a way, because they're the ones who can say, okay, so-and-so has missed 10 classes in a row. I think something's wrong. And we can, you know, step in and try and stop or try and ameliorate that situation, get them the counseling that they need, send them upper campus to talk to the counselors who do a fantastic job every day. And it's that kind of response that we need in the community, whether it's in the schools, at the university level, or in the schools at the high school and intermediate and elementary school level. A lot of these things, they wouldn't end up in jail. They wouldn't be just another statistic for us on the criminal side.
And you're talking a lot about awareness, and perhaps, although we've been talking about mental illness, perhaps a better way of framing that is mental health.
Yeah.
And Tricia, you're nodding at that.
Yes, because as I said, we really want the community to understand that cases such as Mr. Saito's at the Hawaii State Hospital are on one end of the spectrum. That's a very small group of an acute situation, whereas each of us are responsible for our own mental health and can play a role in helping the community. So I think we should look at it holistically and starting from a very young age.
We have a caller on the line from Hawaii Island. Noel, are you on the line?
Hi there.
Hello.
Turn off my radio. Okay. Yeah, my comment has to do with the housing problem, which is critical in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a round of chemo, and I was extremely ill at the time with physical illness. And my rent, my house got sold, and my rent went tripled the amount that it was previously, and I couldn't afford it. And I was sick and not working. So I was in a real bind. I ended up living in my car with my dog. And then I went to IHS after a while. But IHS at that time had a lot of very extremely mentally ill people and that were violent. And so I ended up escaping from IHS, I mean leaving IHS, because it was too dangerous, and went back to my car with my dog.
So you took advantage of traditional services available to the homeless and found out that it was a scary proposition for
you. It was not safe there at all. And the day I left, they served lunch. It was funny. Well, it wasn't funny. That was when I had it. It was like, you know, Wonder Bread with chocolate sauce on it. That was our lunch. And
well,
I was like, you know, I can't survive here. I'm not going to make it out of this alive if I stay here. It was that critical for me. So,
but Noel, your uneasiness that you described, the uneasiness you described was more about the other people who were in the facility with you. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it was mostly about that, but also, like somebody touched upon nutrition, there was that issue as well, that I was, wow, they're really going to give us this kind of poison for food and call it food?
Well,
was really bad, you know, and we could see these coolers with glass doors that had real food in them, but we didn't get them.
But you know what, let's focus more on the issue of that you raised earlier, which is that many severely mentally ill people are homeless. I mean, that's seems to be increasing in numbers. Tricia, is that your observation?
I'm not sure what the actual data is in terms of increase or decrease, but certainly it is a serious problem. And our office is in downtown Honolulu, so we certainly see it with our own eyes. But I think this does go back to those services that we need more of, more outreach, more intensive case management, more services delivered to people on the streets that will help to get them into appropriate treatment and shelter situations.
And also, speaking in terms of stressors, various stressors, Mark, you were talking before about trauma and the importance of dealing with trauma underlying as part of that.
But yeah, and as the caller indicated, losing a household is traumatic, is very stressful, and that alone for some people increases their vulnerability and their risk for mental health challenges and even having a diagnosed mental health disorder or having that disorder be more severe. But I'd like to, if I could for a moment,
sure,
expand on some of the comments that Tricia just made and that she made earlier. We're partnering with Department of Human Services and the Homeless Program Office, and we've been looking at the issue, and you raised it earlier too, around the point-in-time study. And we think there's a lot of need. We do think we're making progress. The progress is very slow. We're trying to target the work that we're doing together with others around individuals, groups, small groups at high need, high risk, and high vulnerability. And we think we're making progress with that through intensive case management and some other programs that we've got. But underlying all this, as the caller did say, are the challenges we've got just from the residential living perspective in Hawaii. Now, it cuts across all groups, but obviously individuals with disability, individuals with income challenges are going to experience that as a stressor to a much greater degree than others. The experience of being homeless is a stressor. So an individual who might not otherwise present with behavioral challenges or diagnosed mental health condition when homeless may in fact now start to look like they've got, have an anxiety disorder, a depressive disorder, and some other problems. And there are all the time high levels of co-occurring substance use challenges for these folks. That's true in general in our state, but maybe a particular issue for a variety of reasons for individuals that are also homeless and have some mental health challenges.
Certainly in terms of overlapping populations and some of that. Aya in Honolulu is on the line. She works with the mentally ill. Aya, what's your question or your comment?
Hi. I appreciate being able to speak on the show. Thank you very much. So I work with the mentally ill, and many of whom are homeless or have been homeless. And I spend a lot of time talking to public defenders and pleading clients' cases in court. Unfortunately, I feel that there's not enough collaboration among the prosecutor's office or the police department with case managers or social workers, because you do see a lot of people getting charges that make it very problematic for them to get housing. And these are often charges that were years ago or are minimal charges, or were just more investigation. You could see that maybe the charges are not even accurate. So I think that that's a huge problem, is that just how the legal system can impact and increase homelessness.
Has that been your experience, Ronette?
So it's been about 5 years since I've actually done criminal cases. But I can I think that it is important in all aspects, for the prosecution and the police department and the public defender's office to work together on some of these cases. Not everything is black and white. There was a time when Sharon Black, the late Sharon Black, had a program where she did intervention. So she would ride with the police if there was a mental health issue, someone is blocking the sidewalk and they're clearly mentally ill. There would be like an intervention instead of sending them to the OCCC, getting arrested for harassment, and then just coming back out the next day to have this sort of a revolving door kind of effect. That some kind of intervention, take them to Kekela Ward, or there would be some kind of treatment for them rather than just being incarcerated. I can see how having a criminal record would cause them to not be able to get housing. The record, I don't know how much can be done about this, because oftentimes they already have a record from other cases. That would mean getting things expunged. I don't know how – that's actually very difficult to do. So to answer your question, it just really depends on what kind of cases you're talking about, what chronic criminal conduct, how far back it was. And, you know, to do expungements, if that wouldn't be at the top of a person's list, you would – probably want to have some kind of project or some kind of dedicated group of public defenders to take care of that. The ability to do that would be probably very low, because we operate on a shoestring, because that's how we are. We're really good at what we do. There are very dedicated people, but they're most concerned with getting people out of incarceration first rather than addressing their homelessness. But I can see how that could be a project that a lot of people would have to work together on.
Another caller has a question, Deirdre from Honolulu. It sounds as if her question might dovetail with what we've just been discussing. Deirdre, are you on the line?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Yeah, what was your question?
I'm just wondering, because there's been a lot of conversation where there's a connection between people who are mentally ill and also homeless. So they experience these two barriers kind of in their everyday life. But I'm just wondering, like, are there any kind of facilities that are set up for them to kind of get like access to medications that they need to kind of like stabilize or normalize their kind of living conditions being mentally ill? If so, how do they do this if they don't have like addresses? Say people don't have a home but are also mentally ill, but they need medication. So where do they go?
Tricia?
Trish, are you able to take that one on?
Our outreach workers from various contracted providers are able to really keep in touch with some of these folks. It depends on the situation where they're deciding to stay. They also do have access to case managers if they're willing, and case managers can go out to people who are unsheltered to try to make sure that they have the basics of medication. It's very challenging, though.
And that establishing a basic relationship is seemingly so much at the heart of a lot of this, but that plays an element in terms of mental health as well.
We're building program capacity for homeless outreach across the state, and we've got a ways to go. This is a challenge in terms of program capacity, but we're making progress. But establishing that relationship, maintaining it, the caller is quite accurate to note it's a challenge for a person whose address keeps changing. Establishing that they've got probably insurance eligibility is a challenge for an individual whose address keeps changing. Taking steps to ensure they're getting appropriate health care is a challenge. And all of those things are worthy of paying attention to and worthy of work together on. We're making progress. We're not the only ones. We're trying to do outreach for individuals with severe mental illness who are also homeless. And as I said, we're working with Department of Human Service Homeless Program Office and other outreach providers throughout the state to try to address the needs of this population. Hard to reach, very concernful, both from the perspective of their lives and the human cost, but also the social cost in terms of physical health problems that they may have and the social cost of addressing those when they become acute or very severe.
Talking about mental health in a wide variety of perspectives with our guests, Tricia Kajimura, the Mental Health America of Hawaii, Mark Fridovich, the Chief of Department of Health, Adult Mental Health Division, and Ronak Kawakami, Richardson Law School, formerly with the Innocence Project and formerly a public defender as well. You can reach us 941-3689 if you're calling from the island of Oahu. If you're calling toll-free from neighbor islands, 1-877-941-3689 on that number.
Mark, many of us, our experience of the severely mentally ill will happen right out on the street. And that there seemed to be far more of that in evidence on the street than there were 30, 40 years ago, which is a product, as I understand it, of the so-called process of mainstreaming that seemed to have, you know, that the mentally ill are not automatically put in facilities anymore. Has that been a marked social change, or is that an accurate perception?
There has been a substantial social change in how our mental health facilities, our psychiatric hospitals, are used. Mm-hmm. And that's true, and that trend has occurred over the course of really the last 50 years.
Yeah.
After World War II, with the development of effective antipsychotic medication, saw most state hospital populations, state hospital census, decrease quite substantially. In 1959, I think at Hawaii State Hospital, there may have been 1,000 or 1,200 residents. Mm-hmm. So both because of effective treatment, number one, number two, because of the development of an effective community mental health system, with both public and private providers providing medicine and psychiatry and group home living, and through law, which said, you know, custodial care really isn't appropriate treatment for an individual with a disability. You have to assess them, you have to treat them, and you can keep them at a level of care no longer than they need that, unless there's a compelling state interest for that. And so from the period in Hawaii from 59 to present, or to about 2012, and across the country, really substantial decrease in the use of long-term hospitalization to address the needs of adults with a serious mental illness. And instead, we've got, I think, thousands of people living in Hawaii in the community in community residence or with their families or on their own, getting medicine, getting treatment, having jobs or volunteering, participating in our clubhouse programs, and leading happy, healthier, and integrated lives as part of their neighborhoods.
You wouldn't have to walk very far from where we are right now to see someone on the street who is clearly in a state of severe mental illness and is getting no benefit whatsoever from how he or she is living, right?
I'm sure that's true. I see them also, and outreach to them is a particular challenge. We are looking at how do we address the needs of an individual who may be refusing to get access to the kinds of services and supports that will be healthier for them in the long run. And I don't think that that problem that we've got in Hawaii and that it exists in other places is strictly a result of the substantial deinstitutionalization that occurred. A lot of it has to do with the cost of housing, here, the favorability of our climate, and the aloha with which, as a state, we regard individuals who are at need.
Well, and although at the same time, feel compelled to point out, we do have the highest per capita rate of homelessness in the country in Hawaii, despite the aloha spirit. But let me ask this just around the table in terms of areas that you have seen, what has proven to be effective and or what is encouraging or perhaps to build on? You mentioned the community coordination. You mentioned the younger folks. But, Tricia, let's start
there. Yeah, I wanted to mention a new initiative that the community has been working on, and it's called LEAD, or Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. It's a partnership between the Department of Health, Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, a coalition of advocates, and in particular, a provider called the Chow Project, and also the Honolulu Police Department with their new chief. They just signed on fully. And what LEAD is going to do is when someone is about to be arrested for certain offenses that are low level, considered victimless and related to things like homelessness, mental health, and drug use, they will be given the option of seeing a case manager, a social worker, instead of being arrested. And if they follow through with that, which will become the entryway to support services like treatment, housing, etc., then the arrest will not be booked. And that will put them at a tremendous advantage and also address some of the concerns that were brought up earlier in terms of being able to be reintegrated into the community. And so we're very hopeful that that pilot takes off and that the state continues to support the growth of it. It's going to be tested in the Chinatown area, and we're really looking forward to seeing some benefits for the community from that. It comes out of a model that was established in Seattle and quite heavily evaluated with great success.
I think we may actually have a well, Mark, go ahead briefly. We've got a caller on the line we want to get to in just a moment.
We've got a partnership with Honolulu Police Department around individuals who need to be taken to emergency rooms for psychiatric evaluation. We're using information from that partnership to refine an intensive case management pilot to help individuals come to the attention of the police or who are in Honolulu lockup overnight, who are homeless, who have SMI, to hook them up quickly.
SMI being?
I'm sorry, serious mental illness.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
But who are at need and not mm-hmm. already connected with either adult mental health or one of our providers, but to connect them up with somebody. They're at high risk. They're vulnerable. They're obvious. They have high profile. And we're targeting this group to change the arc of their lives and to try to make a difference in terms of their behavioral needs, their physical health needs. And it's a small project. It uses information. We're grateful for the participation with Honolulu Police Department. We've had a partnership with them for 7 or 8 years. And we think using information like that to target individuals at high need is really one of the ways to go to try to address high-profile homeless who have multiple problems.
Wanted to get back to again someone with experience in this area. Aya, if you're still on the line, there, are you with us, Aya?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I had to call back because I heard so many comments, and it's pretty much what I do every day.
So I just wanted to address the issue about the difficulty in connecting and building trust with mentally ill homeless people. I've been doing this for years, and I have clients for many years. And I always suggest to people being really empathetic and listening in a non-judgmental way, because I hear a lot of a myth very often that people don't or refuse housing. And that has been very rare in my experience. I've said maybe that's happened maybe once or twice in like the hundreds of people I've worked with. So I encourage people to really be curious and ask them. So if they refuse IHS, say, okay, tell me about that. Tell me why. Why do you refuse it? What is it there that bothers you? Because I guarantee you, you will find maybe a justified reason, maybe not. But then you'll understand them more. And a lot of them actually do want housing, you know. And because housing builds better mental health. I mean, obviously, without a home, we'd all be kind of, you know, losing it, I think. So, you know, that's, and my biggest challenge is actually getting housing for people. You know, the wait lists are years long. You know, you see beautiful buildings going up every day, and none of them are for the low income. You know, so that's the main thing. So I heard about the new liaison between like the police department and helping in industries like my own. But you know, I just think the realistic view is that really we need housing, like for the people. They need a more streamlined application system. They need fewer barriers to attain this housing. There's a lot of barriers in place that are bureaucratic, that are nonsensical, that really create a problem in just getting people into place.
Aya, let me ask you this in terms of your day-to-day work with folks. Is there a single most consistent block that you have in terms of getting your clients into direct help?
I mean, a lot of my clients actually do actively see their doctors. You know, I have very few that are actually addicts. And the ones that are in housing that were addicts usually decrease dramatically in using drugs, I mean, and stop completely. So, you know, I mean, they see their doctors for the most part. Many had records that were minor or long ago. They're not in the records that they may have now, like peeing in a park after hours, even if they have housing, or they get a citation for that. You know, so a lot of them actually do, you know, kind of follow in line to what they're supposed to do. I've been very fortunate to have clients that do that. But, like, the biggest barrier I have is, I mean, filling out the same application 10 different times for all these different buildings that have a wait list that's 3 years long, you know, and then being told that they're going to need a credit check. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. So, or then I had one guy who was denied housing because three years prior, he, like, threw a shoe at a city light and broke the light. So he was down as destroying public property, and he was denied housing based on something like this. You know, I mean, stuff like that is kind of crazy.
Aya, there's so many sub issues that come under this category. Thanks very much for checking in with us. I want to we've just got a few minutes left, and I want to ask our three guests, in a way, what their wish list is. We've talked about problems that we see every day, and you know, if each of you, if you had your druthers, what would you like to see changed, improved, less of, more of? Tricia, do you have a wish list of that kind?
So I'm actually with Aya in that affordable rental housing would probably be first on my list because it is so related to mental health and our homelessness problem here on Oahu that I think. And we're not talking $100 million worth of affordable. We're talking about hundreds of millions worth of affordable rental housing. We have an acute shortage, and we need the political will to start addressing that at a faster rate. It's just critical to our community in so many ways.
That's a lot of political will. Hundreds. That's a lot of money and a lot of political will, right? Ronnie?
Well, my wish list probably is to have a change in people's attitudes towards mental health. This is something pervasive. It's not just other people's problems. People should have more aloha for their fellow man or fellow woman and the people around them. It's I think that if you think about it, okay, how many perfectly well-adjusted people do you know? Including yourself, probably not a whole lot.
Raise
everyone,
your hand.
Yeah. Right. Everyone has some kind of mental health issue, whether it's in their family, whether it's you know their themselves. So you know, there are people who are on the street. It's not necessarily their fault. And if you step back and say, "Wait a minute, this person didn't ask to be born with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. They didn't ask to be standing there not having the wherewithal to be able to bathe themselves or find a place to live. So as just human beings, we should look at that person and think, how can I help them?
And I'll go with what my predecessor said, Aya and Tricia, housing, housing, housing. And Ronnie, like Ronnie said, greater compassion towards one another, greater compassion towards individuals suffering from life's challenges.
You know, I'm sure the compassion is there in the hearts of people, especially as we get into the holidays and we, you know, and ironically, in the holidays, mental illness becomes more of an issue. Depression becomes more of an issue. I guess what I'm saying, Mark, is I don't doubt that the compassion is there, but I'm going back to that hundreds of millions of dollars that you talked about, Tricia, and I'm wondering if that's ever going to be there.
That's a good question.
It's asking there, a lot, isn't it?
And there's a lot of dedicated advocates working on it. That's what gives me hope, that I think that the community advocating for these kinds of changes is getting stronger, getting bigger, and more effective in how they raise the attention of the public and our leaders.
That word hope is pretty critical to the whole idea of getting well, isn't it, Mark?
Well, hope's critical. Hope comes from within. Hope comes from within.
Yeah.
It's critical. I don't think we can give it to other people, though.
Is it? How could it be regained if once it's lost?
Support, outreach, sensitivity, responsivity, tolerance.
I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Our guests have been Mark Fridovich, whom you just heard, Chief of the Adult Mental Health Division for the State Department of Health. Tricia Kajimura is the Executive Director of Mental Health America in Hawaii, and Ronette Kawakami is the Dean of the Richardson Law School, former co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, and a former Hawaii public defender. Joining me and my colleague Bill Dorman here for this edition of The Conversation. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for taking part.